Welcome to the Digital Press. Welcome to the Digital Press's very first official podcast. With our team, roll call.
Mike.
Chelsea.
Nick.
Joe.
Frankie.
We all like the thumbs up a lot here.
I didn't. I put my beer up.
Kind of like a thumbs up.
I guess I'm narrating. So we have our very first subject we've all sort of witnessed or at least had a lot of exposure to the very recent E3, Electronic Entertainment Expo. And we're just going to sort of share some opinions of our impressions of that show this past year.
I was exposed to E3. I used a cream, rubbed it on, and the rash went away.
Really?
I did.
Was it prescription or
something? Nope, over the counter.
Wow.
E3 rub.
We're going to check that out, because...
Made all the hurt go away.
I might need some of that. Anyway.
Well, did we want to start with Nintendo?
Well, we're off to our bag.
Yeah. That's a great start. Well, I was thinking Nintendo, I think, before. So we'd do that last. So. Save the juicy bits.
Because everyone's expecting Nintendo first, so let's get the...
Reverse order of the actual keynotes. Nintendo first.
Right, the big thing at the show, the big announcement everyone was anticipating before it ever started was, you know, Nintendo has a new Wii system out.
The Wii.
The Wii U. Announced and impressions. Anyone?
Wii U. I'll start, I guess. I think that it's one of those things where, like, you don't know what to expect. They do, you know, it's always... You know, Nintendo comes out with something, I'm like, yep, that's a Nintendo machine. You know, it's like, I mean, I can't think of it, you know, I'm not going to think of it negatively, I'm not going to think of it positively, I'm going to think of it like, this is something different or new or something interesting, it's just, and you look at it and you say, well, show me what you got, you know, give me something to play on it, make it worthwhile, and I'm
game. I think there's a certain repeat quality that they were trying to capture with the original Wii, where... When they showed us those Wiimotes, because that was the first thing they showed us about the Wii, we were like, there were a couple camps of people like, oh, this is ridiculous. They're digging their own grave. And then there were some that were like, oh, this is going to change the way we play games forever. Mm-hmm. All gaming is going to be motion control from now on. And this is, they're trying to capture our imagination with a second screen that's built into a motion control device. It's essentially a giant controller with a screen on it.
They built a DS for your TV.
Yeah, essentially.
They're like, man, you know what's really popular? The DS. Let's make that on your TV. Everyone will buy it forever. Yay!
It's an SS, a single screen.
Yeah, single
so
screen.
So it's an S, it's not a DS, it's an SS. Well, you do it. Well, you
the first
have a
screen
TV screen
is a TV, and yeah, the second screen is a handheld.
It does raise... Like, the first thing that popped into my head, though, is that it's almost like they're going that step further that they sort of did half-assed with the Game Boy Advance GameCube connectivity. You know, like, when, at one point, like, you know, you had, like, Zelda Four Swords and everything like that, where it's like,
the Final Fantasy game.
Exactly, the Crystal Chronicles. And I always thought, like, you know, that's probably fun. You know, the idea, like, each person, you know, I could think of it like a football game, picking plays.
Well,
so it'd be nice to have your own private screen. But it never really went anywhere, because, I mean, let's face it, who's going to buy?
Well, that's an investment. You know,
man, talk about
it. Yeah, that's a big investment.
Retreading that. I mean, Namco announced that Pac-Man Versus game called Chase Me on the Wii U. It's essentially Pac-Man Versus repackaged for this, which is cool, because that was one of the best things on the GameCube. Game Boy Advance connectivity.
It was to us, but let's face it, that wasn't a big hit. Like, you didn't hear a lot of people screaming, my God,
well, the fact that
what a great
true.
Game Pac-Man Versus was. I mean, at some point they're like, let's just stick it in with Pac-Man World
right.
so people will play
They didn't sell it. Like, there was no way to just purchase Pac-Man Versus. You had to buy Ridge Racer or whatever that was.
They ultimately jammed it in with Pac-Man World. It's like
Yeah,
but, I mean, really, yeah, they just wedged it into a product to get people on.
I mean, it was always
you
a
You could go back even further, like, to the... You know, the Sega Dreamcast, where they had the little memory cards that you could play the games on and stuff.
Yep.
I mean, it was kind of different, because it didn't really interact with the game while you were playing. You played it differently. I know that you could raise your chows, Sonic Adventure, make your chows awesome.
I don't know. I'm torn on the Wii right now, only because part of me is saying, like, I don't think this is going to take off. I mean, it has some cool ideas, definitely, but I think I'm at the point where I don't think it's going to do well, but I'm also thinking I'm probably going to be proved wrong, and I wouldn't be surprised if I am. So I'm kind of up in the air right now. I would like for it to do well, and I'd like to see it really introduce some new things, really make use of that second screen, do some cool stuff, but at the same time, you know, I can look over to where we have our Wii games and just see all of the shovelware that came out, and it's like...
And do you remember when the original Wii came out, like how you felt about it? I mean...
I was really excited for it.
Were you? Because I
was also younger.
I feel very similar to the way I feel about this. It was like, it's almost an indifference, like kind of like what Mike was saying, like, well, it's Nintendo, they're going to come up with something, you know, sort of creative, they have a sort of an interesting market. And I hope that I'm wrong about this, but I don't know why anybody would want to play games that way.
Yeah.
Am I so old school that I really need to have a television and a wired controller or some way to play where I'm not standing up and waving my arms? I was wrong about the Wii, but not for my own personal playing. Like, I never got into it. So I don't know if this is the next real wave. Is this going to be the one that wows me over? I'm like, oh, you know what? I was wrong about that. And here's what I was really looking for all along.
Well, for me, having that screen or controller, it's not something that I'm thinking that I would use for just any game that I play. But I can imagine it being useful for a certain type. For instance, once in a while I would play those board games, those Dungeon Master board games where one person would be like the Dungeon Master setting up the board, and you'd have like your own little booklet that would have all your information, you know, and all the other players have to like beat you, you know, and I can imagine, you know, the one player who's the master, like has his own personal screen, and basically he's trying to screw over everybody else he's playing against, you know, I mean, there's useful options, I think, but it depends on how people take advantage.
Nintendo has definitely built a sort of marketplace understanding of our technology sells well based on people's imagination. Like, oh, you know, the first piece of marketing they did for the Wii showed people doing things with the Wiimote that I don't think some developers have yet to, you know, people jumping out from behind couches and using it like a machine gun or swinging it like a sword.
I do that.
Well, you hide behind your couch, you know, for other reasons. I don't know where
I'm talking about. Anyway.
On that note.
I try. But, you know, I think there's, they understand that there's a lot of value in showing something and showing the potential of something and not, and, you know, hoping that if they can't do it first party, that some other developer will. And I think that a lot of the Wii stuff, at the end of 6 or 7 years, or however far in we are on the Wii, there's still some really unrealized potential in the hardware, even with the Wii Motion Plus stuff. I thought that was going to bridge a lot of gaps of what can and can't be done, and, you know, other than making Tiger Woods golf a little more accurate, and you know, making you have to put the controller down between every like session of whatever game you're playing so it can recalibrate itself.
There you go.
It doesn't add a tremendous amount of, you know, and that may be the fault of the developers that have kind of like petered out on their, okay, we've done everything we can with this, let's move on to something new, maybe. And maybe that's why the Wii U is here, because maybe the development community is like,
well, I mean, the other problem they're going to have to deal with is that the reason why the Wii was so popular when it started was because it was easy for people to pick up, and it was the cheapest system. So, I mean, is this going to launch the price higher than the other systems, and is it going to make it less accessible for people?
Yeah.
That's why it was such a success in the first place. You know, most people who are, like, hardcore gamers, you know, like, I don't have a Wii at home. I traded in for DJ Hero, and I have no regrets about that. But, you know, like, it's like a family system, so how is it going to change if they have this new piece of equipment that's very expensive? You know, like, do you want to give that to a child to play with?
Or grandma, who was a big, you know, target for the last group.
Oh, man. And think about how big that thing is going to be when they release the inevitable silicone skin that mandatory, like, comes in the box, or Nintendo makes you sign up online on their website to get 4 of them, or however
it's
many.
Just gonna be bubble wrap.
It's already, the thing's already about as big as an iPad across. You add that silicone on, and it's going to be like
the keyboard.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, that thing is huge. I shudder to think of the damage that thing will cause when someone wings it across the room.
Which will inevitably happen.
It will, absolutely. And if it doesn't, there'll be websites that do it on purpose just to see what kind of damage. You
that
know,
thing, Yeah, hopefully that thing is super durable because, you know, you're talking about the difference between a $35 Wii remote versus this thing,
like
which is like a $150 controller, which is basically your whole system in your hands. Might as well just hold your Wii today and just throw it around the room. That's pretty much what would happen if you lost control of that.
Well, I think going back to what you'd said earlier, Frankie, is that the big thing with the Wii U is going to be its potential. Sure, there's a lot of things that... A lot of people saying, oh, well, this would be a great idea for this. Like, people are saying, like, a Fatal Frame game where the controller is, like, the camera to bring up to your face or whatever. That'd be great. Like, some cool ideas floating around, but...
I'm calling Tecmo right now.
There you go. But is anyone going to follow through with it? Is anyone going to take these ideas and really be creative enough to be able to do some really amazing products and IPs on there? It's just going to be a lot more of the same stuff we've been seeing, but
Carnival
now...
Carnival games!
Exactly.
And not more to Carnival
not
games.
To discredit the AAA best-selling game Carnival Games, available at a very fair price, might I add. But it's just, it's taking advantage of the hardware.
Look, to the credit of Carnival Games, you are just about as likely to win one of those games in the video game as you are in real life. So it is very real.
So real.
Well, it just traps, it traps publishers between a rock and a hard place because you're trying to say, well, you know, to maximize your profits, you want to hit as many marks as possible. So you want to, you know, make it multi-console or something like that, multi-platform. But with you know, the Wii or the Wii U, you really, by doing that, you end up sort of limiting yourself to not taking advantage of what the hardware has to offer. So you kind of you have to take your pick. Pick your poison. Do you release something all over the place and make it sort of like the poor man's version on the Wii, or do you make the Wii or Wii U version like an amazing game that takes it full advantage of the hardware, but make it impossible to put anywhere else?
Right. It's gonna change the lead times on the multi-platform stuff. Like, oh well. For our Wii U version of Assassin's Creed, we had to put this, we had to build this radar or stealth mechanic into the controller thing so, Ezio can look at people and see if they're assassins or something, so that added another 5 months onto our development time, so that means all the other versions had to wait so we could go multi-console launch on the same day, those AAA developers like Capcom and Ubisoft and EA, when they see this on stage at the E3, are they like, oh, God, we have to make games on this little screen? And
Look, the really important question is the Wii U tablet going to have two cameras on it? One so I can take a picture while looking at it, and then one so I can take a picture of other people.
I think it is.
Because that really sold me on the DS and the DS.
Camera. I think so.
Well, just so we can talk about other things about E3 and wrap up the Wii specifically, real quick, just in case we never do another podcast again, a year from now, if you're watching this video, does the Wii U succeed? Mike?
I think it does. I don't know if it... I'm not going to say it probably won't sell as much
in
as
10
the Wii.
Seconds.
It won't sell as much as the Wii, but I think it'll be profitable.
I want to say no. I'm probably going to be proved wrong, but... It's like a money thing, especially nowadays. People don't have any extra money. Who's going to want to spend all that money on another thing that's going to be replaced in a year, as Nintendo tends to do?
Nick?
I plead the fifth. I don't know. It really is. It really feels like it's up in the air. I'd like for it to succeed, so I'll say yes.
All right, because a year from now, you don't want to look back.
Exactly.
Why did I say anything?
I shouldn't have put money on this.
I mean, I'm going to say no, but I said the same thing about the Wii. It was, a success. But I can't see myself playing it. Not that I'm an extension of the gaming public in general, but I say, nah, it is going to work.
I think we're seeing the beginnings of Nintendo not being infallible in terms of sales with the 3DS. I think that has had middling sales for a DS system, which has historically been the greatest selling piece of gaming hardware, of the past 10 years, and the 3DS has not seemed to emulate that, so I think the Wii U will probably have the same middling sales, at least to start, and it will probably succeed despite itself.
Is that a yes?
I think yes, it will do okay. I don't think it's going to have the wildfire, must-have, riots at the electronics store during the holiday season that the Wii did.
So, in this segment, we want to talk about, real quick, for each one of us, what was it that excited you, or that you most dreaded? What is it that you're going to take away from E3 2011?
Well, for me personally, it's probably the Vita. The Vita is probably the thing that just sort of hit me as, that's a great price point that hits that addresses every concern that PSP owners have addressed, and I think that that's going to be something that I'm going to be looking forward to.
What is the Vita?
It's the, new PlayStation handheld, the new Sony handheld.
And what makes that different than the old PSP?
It's got, you know, it's actually got a touch screen, like a touch pan on the back. Got the
touch front
and the
touch back.
Yeah,
it's just like me. I like to be touched in the front and the back.
Yeah, in the back. Yeah. Well, wrap with a reach around. Give your system a reach around.
Oh,
come on. This is a family podcast, yeah, Mike.
Says who?
Let's move on to Nick.
All right.
That's your whole thing.
That's why it's great.
There's not a whole lot for me to say.
Well, it looks really nice. Another show.
Don't worry, because I'm going to be talking about the Vita.
Okay. PSP.
Frankie's got your back.
Reach your ass.
Like, well, after that, I figured we're going to stop talking.
I'll just be quiet. Let someone else talk.
So, what excited you, Nick?
To be honest, not too much really excited me. I felt maybe I'm starting to become a little bit jaded with the gaming industry, but I just felt like. I saw some stuff, and like with the Wii, I was like, oh, that's neat, but I didn't feel like, wow, like, I can't wait for this to come out, like, when am I going to be able to get my hands on this? It was just, eh. I know with Microsoft they did a lot of Kinect stuff, which probably isn't even being marketed to my demographic, and I can understand and accept that. I don't feel like they need to market everything to me, because I'm not self-centered, but, it's a message to all you out there who are complaining.
To all the ladies.
Yeah.
Makes a very giving.
I'm the least self-centered person.
But I don't know, it's just nothing really struck me as being really amazing or like as a must-have. And I'll probably look through some of the info again. The Wii U stuff does look cool. The PSP Vita does look pretty neat. It does have some really impressive graphics for a handheld, which really hasn't been seen on that scale, and I don't think ever. The touch front, the touch pads have a lot of potential, but like I said before about the Wii U, whether developers are actually going to be able to work with that potential is something completely different. And hopefully they do, but realistically, probably not. So yeah, I really wasn't too impressed with this year's E3.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Nick and say that I wasn't terribly impressed. Most of the games that were announced were sequels, so I mean, I'm sure they'll be good, but there's not anything that really holds my interest. Kind of like back to what you were saying about like a lot of the new stuff that's going on having potential, they're going to run into the problem where, you know, before developers could make a game and they could just kind of transpose it to all the other systems, just, you know, like kind of make one game and then like recode it slightly to fit all the other systems. But now everything's kind of splitting off. We have Kinect, Wii U, like obviously something that's coming out for the DS is like the 3DS isn't going to be able to come out for the PSP anymore, you know, and you're going to have that same problem with, you know, I mean, it kind of started with the Wii, but you know, you could still kind of, they tagged a lot of the motion controls on, or they would just have it where you could, you know, hold the controller and play it. But now it's going to be much more expensive for people to develop games. Just because they have to develop for three completely different platforms now, as opposed to just making one game and putting it on different platforms.
Do you think as a result either that we're going to see a lot less multi-platform stuff, or you think that because of that we're going to see a rise in development costs and therefore a rise in price points for games?
Well, I mean, I think we're already having the problem where the development costs are so expensive that there's not a lot of original stuff coming out. We've, like, you know, like E3 aside, we've, like, split into this whole, like, there are these $60 games that are sequels, and then there are like the $2 or $3 games like that are apps that are actually really creative and fun, and there's not a lot in between. Like, you're never going to get a really creative game on one of the bigger consoles because it costs so much to make. But yeah, that's kind of like where E3 was going for me. It's like all the really, really big games that are coming out are sequels. Not really that interesting to me. I'm a downer.
Sounds like a pretty tepid, you know, feeling overall. And I, again, I'm just going to kind of fall right into line here. I exhibited at E3. I've been wearing my lanyard ever since I left. It's playing merry hell with the back of my neck, but I was representing the Video Game History Museum, which was a booth of approximately 3,000 square feet. We were actually bigger than Atari's booth, exhibiting old school stuff. And the whole concept of this is that we're planning on opening an actual museum in San Jose or in Silicon Valley somewhere within the next 5 years. So our point there was, let's try to get the industry sort of involved and aware of what we're trying to get done here, that is archiving and basically creating a showcase for our illustrious, you know, history and the very deep video gaming roots that we're all part of. That's really all I have to say about it. I don't want to plug it too much. Most people have seen this, probably have already been nagged to death by me to contribute something towards it, so I will just leave it at that. That was my E3 takeaway. Q?
can't forget the roots. You got to, as we exponentially move forward in this industry, we cannot forget where everything started. And if we forget, thankfully there are companies like Namco that keep selling us Pac-Man and Galaga over and over again. And
can you zoom in on my cool. This was an E3 exclusive, just for playing the new Galaga game.
Joe's got bugs on his neck.
Thank you.
I was excited by the Vita, but Sony has done a lot of press on Next Generation Portable over the past, you know, however many months since they first introduced it, and it wasn't a reveal. It was the price point that was the most exciting for most people because we've been waiting, and I don't think they had any other choice but $250. That was it. It has to have parity with Nintendo's console in this marketplace because, like Chelsea said, we are moving into an era where things are either easily digestible apps or they are full-featured games, and the Vita is going to be able to do both of those, which is exceptionally cool. It's going to have a marketplace that's going to allow developers to create DLC games similar to the PSN and the Wii Shop and Xbox Live, but it's also opening some stuff up to Android compatibility, which is, you know, Android is probably the most saturated operating system in smartphone market right now. It's, you know, eclipsed even the iOS with the iPhone. So there are apps being developed for that, and if they're compatible with the PlayStation Suite, they will be playable on the smartphones that can play those games and the Vita. And it's the Vita is a Swiss Army knife of everything. It can do everything. It's gonna have the dual analogs. It's gonna have the touchscreen functionality, the gyroscopic motion control. I'm sure it's gonna have PS3 interconnectivity. It's one of those things where people who like to look at the potential of hardware, like we were talking about with the Wii U, people who like to think about the future and say, wow, this is amazing, look at the specs and what this hardware can do. I can only imagine what these third-party developers who sit down with these dev kits and say, now what can we do to maximize this? I see great things for the future of the Vita. I think it's going to move in the appropriate amount forward for handheld gaming in terms of system power, in terms of what you can do with the system, in terms of internet connectivity. It's going to also have a 3G option, so people who want to pay the extra on a monthly basis can stay connected anywhere they go. They don't have to be in a Wi-Fi zone. But other than that, I mean, the Microsoft Kinect stuff, Microsoft's presentation was almost 100% Kinect, with the exception of Halo 4.
The new Halo trilogy.
The new, yeah. Finish the fight? Wasn't that what the last Halo was supposed to be finished?
This was start a new fight.
Start a new fight.
Or pick a fight.
Pick a fight.
Be a bully.
Punch someone in the face.
That's, oh man, that would be awesome if that was the tagline for Halo 4. Halo 4, punch someone in the face. Kick someone in the balls. You know, it's amazing, you know, with the Kinect, last year Microsoft dropped it and it sold really well. It has a really decent install base. So no shock that they've supported it incredibly with all of this and the third party people. And I don't know whether that was mandate. I don't know if Microsoft, you know, said to all the third party people, develop for Kinect this year. We need you developing for Kinect. But it seemed like a lot of energy being put into Kinect, and I guess that's great for people who invested in it. Unfortunately, my living space does not have a 6-foot range between the television and where I sit, so I can't buy a Kinect. Unless I buy that Nyko range limiter, which you put on the Kinect, that I think they debuted that at E3 as well. But, so you can play in a smaller space. It's like a reverse refracted lens.
Yeah, that works.
That's, I'm interested in that. So maybe I will be able to be part of the Kinect family next year. But by that time, Microsoft may retract that mandate. Maybe they won't need to have so much development going on.
Yeah, you can dance and look like a fool like everyone else.
Yeah, I'm never going to buy Dance Central or whatever those games are called. I'm never, you can mark my words, never gonna buy those.
I look like a fool anyway, I don't have to dance.
But, yeah, other than the Vita, the Wii U has me a little baffled, and Microsoft's presentation, I have no objectivity. I don't own a Kinect, so to me it's like, and I didn't see anything in their presentation that said, I have to buy a Kinect for that Star Wars game that looks incredibly not good. You know, that's not it for me yet. You know, if there was a Kinect version of Dragon's Lair or something, I'd consider it. But, you know. So that's it for me.
Are you sure that's all?
Yeah. The Video Game History Museum. I can't wait to buy. Is it going to... You have to buy tickets?
You will need to buy tickets, right. But that's still, you know, we need a building before you can do that.
Yeah, you can just do it in a parking lot somewhere.
The shadiest museum.
That was
museum.
The plan.
It's just the back of a van.
You're the back of a van.
That's all it is.
You want to see some video games, guys?
Hey, kid, you like video games?
It's like the bookmobile, except video game history.
Yeah, it will all be well-designed when it's happening, but for now, it's really kind of a concept that we need a lot of people to get together
we're
on.
Pretty much at the museum right now.
Work in progress.
Yeah, we kind of are. So let's move on to our next segment, which I don't know what it is yet, but we'll edit that in later.
Something I wanted to bring up was there's been a lot of attention, a lot of focus on hacking that's been going on for a lot of game companies by a group called Lulsec. Lul Security is what the full name is. They started out, they took credit for a lot of the Sony hacking that went on attacking their servers. And then later on they attacked Brink, got a bunch of user information. Sony Media, I think, is one of the servers they had gotten, and they said they were just storing people's information in plain unencrypted text. Later on, Bethesda, Minecraft, and a bunch of other companies are really getting attacked. And for me, it brings up the issue that with so much focus that's going on as far as reducing internet anonymity, if I can say that correctly, that this is really just going to be used as cannon fodder, just evidence as to support bills and stuff like that, which are going to limit that even more. Not to mention even just attacking small companies that, you know, Mojang with Minecraft, where they aren't really doing... If it was big corporations, you kind of understand, like, oh, these are the big evils of the game industry and whatever, but when you start attacking indie companies, it's hard to really understand what their motives are and just why.
I think that big or small, that there's a kind of just... It's like a drug. You know, like, you know, you get your kicks, you know, messing with things that seem impenetrable or that are said to be impenetrable, and you sort of like, it's like, you know, you bring it down. It's like you see, like, you know, it's like whether it's the United States government or the little, you know, the little company that's, you know, just starting out, you know, you just sort of, like, you know what, I can mess with this, you know, and I'm gonna get my kicks messing with it, you know. Now, whether or not that's going to result in, you know, like, government intervention regarding, like, you know, reducing internet anonymity, I don't necessarily think so, because I think that in the end these are still criminal acts, you know. So it's like, you know, if someone breaks into a store, you know, and steals credit card information, it's kind of the same idea, you know, breaking into, you know, a server and stealing information. It's, you know, so I don't think that there is as much of a need for intervention in that field. I think that there needs to be sort of a mental reanalysis in the sense where, you know, a lot of people initial reaction blame Sony, as opposed to the fact that Sony was the victim of a criminal attack. You know, whereas people aren't so concerned about catching the bad guys; they're concerned about Sony paying the price, yeah. You know, and I think that that's a misguided way to look at it.
I think that we saw a lot of that, and you and I personally had discussions about, you know, how we were sympathizing, like, you know, it must feel really terrible to be, you know, an employee at Sony right now, mm-hmm. where there's so much vitriol on the internet, like, yeah, Sony's getting what they deserve because they took our, you know, friggin' Linux from our PlayStations, it's all their fault, they deserve this, and... You know, I sat back and I said, okay, there's definitely a faction of internet users, people on the web, so, you know, even people who own PlayStations, who they have their motivations or their reasons to feel that this is acceptable to happen, despite the fact that there was hundreds of thousands of people's personal information that was compromised. But then it has kind of... these hackers, whether it's Anonymous or LulzSec or whoever else is responsible for these things, are going and they're kind of pulling back the curtain and going, oh, it's not just Sony we're going to fuck with. It's all these other companies. Exactly. And they've gone after Nintendo's websites. They've gone after Sony's motion picture websites. They've gone after the independent developers like Minecraft. And it's almost, you know, it's a giant question marks. Like, what's the motivation? And it just, it seems bizarre, but it all comes back to hooliganism. It's just people who are smart enough, who have the tools, who have the ability, who know the ins and outs of web security, of these servers and these systems, just doing it to, you know, get their kicks, get their laughs, and ultimately make all of the lay people pay the price. And then on the other side of the coin, all of the data in the Sony compromise, all of the data in all these websites that have been compromised, I'm not certain if there has been, I could be wrong, but as far as I know, there hasn't been any quantifiable, demonstrable acts of actual fraud that's gone on with credit card numbers or personal information. Like, I'm not certain if that would even be provable, but it doesn't seem like the people that are doing this are actually stealing credit card numbers to go make fraudulent purchases, aren't stealing user information to go, you know, fake IDs to get, you know, a passport or a social security card or something that they could use to do things that identity theft organizations do. I think they really probably are teens, 20-somethings, you know, out there having their lulls. You know, it's this 4chan mentality, that website that's very hip and cool with the youngsters where they talk in their 4chan leet speak and they do things just to impress each other, just to make each other laugh. And it's kind of pathetic and sad, but I think that's where most of this all goes back to. It's just those guys doing that kind of stuff.
It's hard to put a face to it, you know, so that what ends up happening is when you have, like, anonymous people committing crimes, it's easier to attack the face as that you know. In this case, it would be Sony or whatnot, yeah, than it is to focus on the fact that, you know, there was actual crimes committed. You know, it's like, you know,
yeah,
I mean, it's human nature. I'm not saying that I don't get it. I'm just saying that I think you need to take a step back and reanalyze. You know?
Yeah, and I've seen some people, some sympathizers, or, you know, people who just don't care, or people who are pro, you know, fuck these corporations, or, you know, even fuck the indie developers. They're like, yeah, well, if they don't have good enough security, they deserve to be screwed. But, I mean, if you lock your door at night and somebody breaks into your house, it's still, you know, you didn't ask for that to happen. Even if you accidentally leave your door open, that doesn't mean you deserve this stuff to happen. And to hide behind any other excuse, any other reasoning, any other logic, it's ridiculous. The bottom line is that a criminal activity is a criminal activity. You know, it's just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. You know, any of us could drive down the street and run somebody over with our car. It's like, we don't.
Yeah,
we,
sure.
Just, we don't. We have the means, we have the intelligence, we have the ability, we just don't do it. It's like, you may be smart enough to know how to hack in to a web server because you know the flaws, because you've read up on every version of every server security number, you know, version, and you're like, oh, I know how to exploit that flaw. I'm going to take down the Sony Motion Pictures website or get into Minecraft and get all that user data. But you just don't. You just don't, because it's not the right thing to do. And if these people, the LulzSec, I've seen the kind of their mission statement is that, oh, we're out helping people because we're finding the exploits, and we're going in and we're, you know, showing them to the people who run these How about knowing what the exploits are and contacting the webmaster and picking up a phone and going like, hey, I'm Joe Lulzsec. By the way, I know an exploit for your web server. Here's how to patch it. Instead of going in there and copying their database of all their user IDs and publishing them in a PDF. Mm-hmm. That's not the right way to do it if you want to help people. Yeah.
I know how to rob that bank, so I'm gonna go break into that vault and take all the money.
Well, it comes down to, I mean, with Sony, people say they rely upon the idea that, oh, it's because they took away our Linux, but if that never happened, or if Linux is never part of the equation, the same thing would have happened. They would have done it anyway, behind some different reason, behind some different motive, but it still would have happened regardless.
The face might be different. Maybe it would have been some other company, or the scenario might have been different, but ultimately nothing is foolproof. No. You know, and I think, you know, we have to understand that, you know, no internet security is ever going to be foolproof.
Yeah, if there's one thing we've all learned, and I think the world has learned, and there were some internet security experts that spoke out about the Sony thing and said, everyone's acting like this is like some new thing, like government websites, the CIA, the FBI, they get hacked on like small levels or moderate levels all the time. It's not new, it's just this happened to be something that was pop culture relevant and had an organization that was promoting it.
It was publicized.
Yeah, these people were handing out flyers, the anonymous group were handing out flyers anti-Sony Day, where you should all boycott Sony, and Lulzsec has a Twitter feed, they have a website, like a funny 4chan-esque website. So these people are, you know, they're out there making their anonymous popularity, they're creating their own memes of themselves on the internet in doing all of this, but this stuff is not new. Nothing is ultimately secure. That's why they keep patching web security and they keep making newer versions of things, and when people figure out how to exploit stuff, they have to patch it. It's just the way that things always have been. Or they make a bigger, better version of whatever security program that they're using. It's not new, it's just the way these things happen.
The cat and mouse. Yeah. Just keep going.
I think we're done with this topic. Do you guys have anything else to say?
I like on Lulzsec's website, it's got, they play the Love Boat theme, like an MP3, and it has a thing in the lower right-hand corner where it says mute, and when you click it, it says volume increased by 50%.
Yeah.
So, props to them for that. Yeah. Otherwise, stop hacking websites. It's bad.
No. Slap them on the wrist.
If you just made a funny website with a Love Boat theme, that would be awesome.
I should check that out then.
They probably steal your information as soon as you hit it.
Actually, you hit that IP.
Yeah. Do it from like a computer at some.
Your couch disappears. They're actually robbing you in the process.
My bank account's been credited, been debited $20. What happened?
So yeah, that's hacking.
Okay. Hi, my name is Mike, Killer Squirrel on the forums. We are going to talk about what game you should be playing. Personally, I think the game that you should be playing is Child of Eden, which is currently available for the Xbox 360. It will be available in September, I believe, for the PlayStation 3. If you've ever played Rez, which is available for the Dreamcast originally, the PlayStation 2, it's also a downloadable game for the Xbox 360 Live Arcade. This is kind of a pseudo-sequel to that title. Graphics are trippy, awesome. If you like that kind of Jeff Minter-esque type of crazy visual thing going on.
Who's Jeff Minter?
Jeff Minter is a mastermind of the trippy visuals. He actually is the founder and creator of a lot of the games on, if not all the games, on LlamaSoft, which actually started as Atari 8-bit computer game development back in mid-80s. But he has been most known for the Tempest 2000. He also did, if I'm not mistaken, Defender 2000. And he did the much maligned, but I think it's freaking awesome, Space Giraffe on the Xbox Live Download Arcade. Most people thought it was Tempest. It's not Tempest. If you play it in a different way, not like you would play Tempest, you'll kind of start to understand what it is. But it's That's his kind of forte. He also did the virtual light machine, the visual light machine for the Jaguar CD. If you put a music CD in a Jaguar, you're going to see some crazy, trippy graphics that are awesome. He also did the Xbox 360. He did the 360 trippy
visualizer
as well. So if you put a CD in an Xbox 360 and you are rocking out to the amazingly awesome Tim McGraw album that I know all you people are loving, you will see some crazy mind-altering graphics that can only make the music so much better. But so actually, though, to get back onto Child of Eden, which I'm awful at the guy's name who created Resident. Can anybody help me out with that?
I can't remember.
Something Japanese.
Mizuguchi, maybe? Or I could be. Yeah. I could be completely wrong, and I wish I had it in front of me because now I look kind of... Break out that phone. Quick on the phone. But anyway, Child of Eden, pseudo-sequel of Rez. Everyone should be playing it on the Xbox 360. If you do not have the Xbox 360, go and get a Slim because more than likely that will not red light, red ring of death. But nonetheless, you can play the Child of Eden. Basically, what it is, the story, I'll make it very quick, is...
Tetsuya Mizuguchi.
Thank you. Tetsuya Mizuguchi. Awesome. He made Resident Evil, a lot of really good Sega games. What it is, basically, the idea is that there's this girl named Lumi. She was the first person that was born in a space station. She had actually passed on, and her essence went into the internet, which they call Eden in the future. So she is the child of Eden. Eden, you need to save, which is the internet. You need to save the internet. And in order to save the internet, you will also save Lumi. And basically, it's a kind of a music rhythm shooting, trippy game that's just amazing that everybody should play. I cannot describe it more than that, but awesome.
Does anybody have a tally on how many times Mike said trippy?
Trippy.
I'm going to guess around 7 or 8.
That was probably a lot more than that, but thank you for
being generous.
It may have been as many times as people came to the door while we were recording.
That's right. Well, no, it's actually
much more than that.
Maybe more. Yeah, I did say trippy.
You only had like
but
five or six.
It's awesome. It's awesome. Anyway,
that was
Mike,
so trippy.
It was trippy.
In post production, Mike, put a count on the bottom. I fully expect to see a tally.
I will be doing post production, so all this crazy visuals you will see will be from me. All
right,
Mike.
I would say that right now. What I'm personally been playing, and what I think everybody should be playing, is Tetris Attack, or in other forms, Pokemon Puzzle League, or Paddle the Pond. I think it is the best puzzle game ever. It doesn't have anything to do with Tetris. It's basically, you know, you have a small cursor that flips blocks back and forth. There are a number of different blocks, different colors, different shapes, and if you form at least three in a row, horizontally or vertically, they disappear. And the more blocks in a row you get, or the more combinations you get where, you know, you make blocks disappear, others fall down on top, it will send garbage on top of the opposing player. And the opposing player has to make combinations in order to eliminate those lines of garbage. And basically, it's just you're sending crap back and forth at each other, and it gets really intense, and, you know, matches can last, you know, 30 seconds, or they can last, you know, 8-9 minutes sometimes, and it just time goes by and you're playing matches over and over again with the same like group of people, and you know hours can go by just you know banging this out and just fantastic. You know, I would say better than you know the Super Puzzle Fighter. I think
blasphemy.
Yes, it's better than Super Puzzle Fighter. It is better than you know. Better than Dr. Mario. I think it is the finest, you know, puzzle game.
But is it better than
Zenji? Zenji on the 8-bit computer.
I've never heard of Zenji. Tell us
Zenji.
Is it trippy?
It is not trippy, surprisingly, but it's awesome. And I'd have to say, should be puzzle game that be remade. Tetris has been made 30,000 times. It's a great game. Zenji, Activision 85, I want to say, came out on the Commodore 64, the Atari 8-bit line of computers. ColecoVision. If it's not on ColecoVision, the game sucks. That's just what it comes down to. I've spoken.
I don't know. I wasn't going to say Zenji. I was going to say Magical Drop 4. But
oh, that's also a good game.
That's a good game.
Attack
is better.
It's not Zenji.
Better than Money Exchanger?
Money
Puzzle Exchanger?
Money Puzzle Exchanger.
Money Puzzle Exchanger.
Awesome game. Yes. Not Zen.
I agree, though. Tetris Attack is awesome. I remember when it came out, I was like, oh, Nintendo's so smart, they put the word Tetris in here.
Yeah, exactly.
That has nothing to do with it, but it's such a good puzzle game that it got people aware of it.
And if you play Pokemon Puzzle League on the N64, you can have, like, the Pokemon screaming things while you're playing.
There is actually, it's only been released in Japan, but there's a version of Paneled Upon on, like, the game, like, I think it's called, like, Nintendo Puzzle Collection or something like that. It's actually a four-player version of what's effectively Tetris Attack, and it's fantastic.
Frankie,
I have been playing. See, there's a silver lining to all these horrible hacker things we were talking about, is that Sony, they're welcome back after almost 30 days or more of downtime. They gave all PSN members two free games from the PSN, from a select group of games. Two for their PlayStation 3 and two for their PSP, if they have a PSP. And one of the two for the PS3 is Infamous, a game that it looked really interesting, and I passed on it at original MSRP pricing. I passed on the Greatest Hits version of it, and I said, I'll wait. I have a backlog. We all have backlogs. And it took Sony giving it to me for free to actually play it, and now I see that, yes, absolutely deserving of whatever critical acclaim it got, and, you know, the sequel, it's great marketing for them. Like, here's a full version, you know, the first in what is surely an excellent sequel. The early reviews on Infamous 2 have been outstanding, and I'm probably going to pick that up when I put enough time into the first one, or I finish the first one, I'll grab Infamous 2. I will not wait, and I think anybody who, similar to me, had a massive backlog of PlayStation games, hurry up, go online, get it for free, or go out and buy it on disc, if you like your physical copies of whatever to sit on your shelf with the rest of your disc-based games. It's an excellent, excellent game. It's somewhere in between, to speak of it in familiar terms, somewhere between Crackdown and Assassin's Creed in terms of the free-roaming city that you traverse and also the kind of craziness of the powers that your character has, where in Assassin's Creed, you know, you can't leap off the top of the spire of a building and make it all the way to the ground without splatting. You can go nuts in Infamous. You can dive off the top of the buildings. As your powers increase, you can, you know, use your electricity to float. You can skirt across electrical currents on the train tracks. You can, and it has that good bad mechanic that's so appealing in some of these sandbox games. Because, you know, in most of these sandbox games, I think we typically go the hero route. But if you're feeling like you want to kill all the pedestrians in Infamous, you get rewarded for that as well. It builds towards your evil presence. And
which brings us to this question: good or evil? What are you, Frankie? Are you good or are you evil?
I'm good right now. I'm going the good route, but I'm gonna see if I can find that halfway point in the game where it's not too late, and I'll make a save file there, and then I'll go nuts both ways. I'll have one save going where I'm just obliterating all the innocents, and then I'll have the other route where I go the good. And from what I understand, there is some reward in the second game. If you start out Infamous 2, depending on what route you went with your save file, you get some reward. I don't know if it alters the story like it would in a game like Mass Effect, but it does have some effect, which is appealing. You know, it's nice to see things carry forward in this era of games where everything's on your hard drive, your save files are persistent, and yeah. So Infamous, if you haven't tried it, it's free on PSN. Go get it.
I have to say, the whole time, after you made that comparison and said it was like Assassin's Creed and Crackdown, I was thinking they should have named the game Ass Crack, and that's all I could think about, like, the whole time. I'm very sorry. I was really paying attention, but I was like,
That would be.
She is sitting a little bit behind you too, Frankie. So.
You know what? I don't know who to call, Microsoft or Ubisoft to pitch that. But I should get in touch with one of them. Crossover potential.
So, ass crack aside, I've been playing, as anyone who knows me knows, I'm always playing Harvest Moon. you know, I think that everybody should at least give one of the games a try. The best ones are probably the N64 and the PlayStation 1 versions, which are difficult to find, but hey, emulators. The one that I'm playing right now is Island of Happiness. It's great for anybody that loves, like, micromanagement games, like any, like civilization-building games. It's kind of like that, only there's more, like, fruit. And the online competitions are great because nobody plays, so you almost always win something. You know, I'm not super happy that the new Harvest Moon is on 3DS because I don't really understand what 3D would bring to a farming game. I mean, besides making like jokes about
3D. Whoa, those turnips! They're coming right at me!
Whoa!
You know, like, oh man, my tree is like popping out of the screen! You know, it's just kind of stupid. And you know, obviously anybody that plays something like Farmville, which I think is like, the worst thing that's ever happened to you. Anyone that's ever played something like Farmville, you can just get Harvest Moon, like, either emulated or, you know, on DS, and spend a whole lot less money to play the same game. The only difference is that you can't, like, send fruit to your friends or whatever, but I don't really know why you'd want to send fake fruit to people anyway. That's just me.
The bad thing about going last in this segment is that I've changed my answer probably 3 or 4 times since we originally started it, but if they're going to settle on Mirror's Edge, which came out, there was a lot of bad press when it came out, a lot of mixed reviews, but I bought it really cheap, probably $10 about there at that point. I absolutely love the game. I love the art style they use in it. It's a very simple, but everything just, it looks amazing. There's a lot of really great detail in some certain places in it. I like the simple color schemes. I just like how simple the control scheme is, where it's just...
You're just a simpleton, man.
I am, you know? I enjoy the simple things in life. I live in a log cabin. You know what? That works.
Made of Lincoln logs.
But it's just really simple to get into. I think it's a game that anyone can really get into and really enjoy. There's an option you can use weapons and guns in the game, but you can run through it just as easily without using any weapons at all. And it's just a really fun experience. I know I've actually gotten my mom to play it a few times, and she's really enjoyed it. I feel like it's very accessible, and it's really something that people might have gone over, might not have paid too much attention to early on. But I feel like now that it's easy to go back to, it's fun and it's enjoyable. I don't understand why I got so much bad press in the beginning.
Well, you brought up that you waited for it to be $10. If you had paid MSRP, $49.95,
$59. It was
$60
when it came out. I know,
because I pre-ordered. I'd pay $30 or $40 for it, and I would feel fine with that. $60, maybe not, but I'd be just as happy if it were for $30 or $40.
I felt justified when I purchased it because I pre-ordered it, so I thought of it as I got a $30 game and a $30 bag. Because I didn't feel like the game was worth it.
Joe loves that bag.
He does love that bag.
It's a good bag. Anyone who doesn't have Mirror's Edge, you should at least try to get the bag.
Just get the game, it's so cheap.
Are you looking forward to a potential sequel?
I would love to see one, although I don't think there's going to be.
Did you play any of the DLC?
I have not. I should actually check that out when I have more money.
I was a little bit happier with the DLC because I thought that's what more of the game should have been. It was more like time trials. It wasn't like modeled after cities. Like, it still had the same kind of like color scheme, but it was more like exploring your own options and traversing the landscape. Whereas I think that they emphasized when the game came out too much that it was like, oh, you can choose your own pathway through the city, when really it's like you can choose like one of three pathways and then bottlenecks, and then you can choose one of two pathways, and then it, like, you know, I mean, that was kind of a letdown for me, is it advertised itself as being a little bit more open world than it ended up being. It was kind of disappointing in that sense.
But I'll check out the DLC. I'll report back in the next podcast, maybe, when I thought about that.
So in this segment that we call Tales from the Store, we're going to tell tales from the store. And the tale for this first segment of our very first podcast is one of the trade-ins that we got. Kind of a sad story. I don't like to make light of it, but I had a very regular customer who used to come in every Saturday, two older gentlemen. They would come in and buy very current era stuff. They would play PlayStation 3 games, they would play Xbox 360 games. Didn't seem to be very interested in the older games, and really always wanted to get whatever was new. I found out after seeing these guys less and less and less that one of these gentlemen was very ill, and then discovered about 3 weeks ago that one had passed away. His wife and son came to the store to basically trade in everything that he had. And I have that here in the store. We're ready to sort of go through it, figure out what it's worth, what we're going to sell, what we're going to put on eBay. Why don't we take a walk this way, shall we? So there were a lot of boxes. Everything was in banker's boxes. His wife was very organized, kept things in alphabetical order, had provided me lists ahead of time so I knew exactly what it was that I was working with. But it was still much different seeing it firsthand than it was looking at it on the list in Excel. I can show you, for example, now, normally I would look at a box like this, or several of them, all marked Xbox, and say, oh no, not more Xbox games, because typically we turn people away when they bring these in. But, as you can see, this gentleman really was a collector, and didn't spend a lot of time playing so much as he did amassing games. So almost everything that was traded in is sealed, factory sealed. Many things, sort of sealed and organized alphabetically as well.
So. My friend John worked for Hypnotix before they got bought by EA, the makers of the Outlaw golf game. So I also have a full collection of sealed Outlaw games for the Xbox.
Yeah,
I enjoy them.
Definitely. A lot of these games were, you know, bargain bin, closeout type titles, but I mean, things like Otogi 2 and some of the Star Wars games that I've seen in here, I've only seen in sort of bad condition in the past, so it was definitely nice to see it.
And it's nice when you have that volume of games that are not the standards you'd still find sealed today. You know, it's an odd rarity when you have a collection and it's all sealed to, you know, like you said, some of those games you'd only see beat up because they were probably not produced in high numbers and were all opened and played with.
And yeah, definitely cool to see sort of all together like that. I put some of the game peripherals and some things. So this the Steel Battalion for the
sealed?
Xbox has never been opened.
Wow, a brand new Steel Battalion. Holy crap. You mind
brand
if I...
new. Guaranteed that it works.
Look at that.
I don't think this was ever opened. The Onimusha Demon Siege katana that you could, you know, stab your friends with, sort of an early motion controller type of thing. And then, you know, we were just talking about the Ace Combat 6 controller and how kind of weird it is, but definitely not weird when you're looking at it in a box like that. It's very, very cool. So we had a bunch of things like this. Some of these I haven't opened. In fact, there's one I wanted to open for the first time while we're here. Now, I told him, please don't bring me any magazines, because he had also been subscribing to everything for years and years and years, and apparently this guy has a collection from the 90s. Every single magazine ever produced in mint condition, which is cool in theory, but no matter how big your store is or your storage space, there's never room enough for every single GamePro and EGM. I don't know if this is good or not. To be honest with you, I'm looking at it for the first time. She said that this was all sort of limited edition strategy guides. It doesn't appear to really be that. They're just strategy guides. This is from Prima's and Brady Games. Oh,
there's your magazines underneath.
Like, I guess the bottom one.
Oh, so it's like an inside. Yeah. I guess it's like probably a pre-order bonus. An Insider's Guide to Mercenaries 2. It seems like something that would kind of be.
Yeah, I guess so. Most of these are pretty common. But yesterday I'd gone through sort of the things that I thought were going to be interesting. Took some photographs and started to log them in. Actually, this is kind of cool too. A few little peripherals off to the side here that are kind of cool to get on the camera. I mean, you don't see this very often. 3DO peripherals in general are pretty rare. So the gun and the flight stick are very, very hard to find, and especially hard to find, practically not used. I guess he did actually bust this one out. The guy was obviously into flight stick stuff. And that's the one.
What was the flight games for 3DO? I can't remember off the top of my head.
Well, I mean, I
think they were all the space ones.
Yeah, Flying Nightmares.
Maybe.
There was that one.
Shockwave and Shockwave 2.
I guess.
Yeah, so like the futuristic.
The Wing Commander games were maybe
Control,
used it for,
maybe.
But yeah. I would think the only one I can think of that was an actual plane would be Flying Nightmares. I can't think of anything else. Yeah. But let's take a look. Some of the cooler stuff I had already brought down. For these, see what we got. So, so a lot of the stuff was used. The guy definitely did play, and I put some of the things that I thought, these are the types of games that I would have played too, or that would be interesting to our customers,
that you don't see very often. Oh, that's not one of them actually traded, but Einhander in the Hunt. He had the Elemental Gearbolt. There's a Silent Hill. If you peek into the box, I mean, you just see a lot of these things are fairly common games, and everything in this box was open. But if you check out, more amazingly to me, are the games that he didn't play on some of these systems that are really, really hard to find new. So, I mean, if you just look at the top row of this, and some of these titles are pretty highly sought after. Thunder Force, Vanark, I mean, these are titles that we hardly ever get traded into the store in any condition. Vampire Hunter D, Silhouette Mirage, Iron Soldier, I mean, I've honestly never seen that game traded in. And they had all, so everything that's in this whole box here is basically just not open.
Wow.
Yeah.
Never. All of us who have a backlog of current gen games to play are all probably feeling really diminished.
You were not going to catch up. Yeah, nope. We would have never caught up. So
I am Commando.
And just to go through the rest of it real quick, it's all more of the same of that type of thing, but in my opinion, it's kind of hard to ever really see too much of that. Like, this one I put together, he had a whole bunch of boxes of PS2 games that weren't open, but to me this was a box of stuff that were like almost every single game is something somebody's looking for. Silent Hill, Rez, Lupin, I know Frankie will appreciate that. That's
yep.
In there.
Gotta love Lupin the Third. Unless you play that game, you might think twice about how much you love Lupin.
Are these all PS2 games?
These are all PS2.
I saw Skygunner. No, that's
Skygunner and Skygunner 2, which... There's a Skygunner 2 in there somewhere, which I have never seen before.
I never even didn't know there was. I just picked up a copy of Skygunner actually from someone off the forums.
There's a Skygunner 2. I don't see it.
Disaster Report.
Battleframe 2, still sealed. Artest Final. Oh, Lifeline, that game is awful. I want the microphone, we have to tell the girl what to do. I don't understand what you're telling me.
Wow, look at that. And a lot of them still have the.
Yeah,
price labels.
Price tags are still on it.
Hang tag intact.
I don't think they made a US. The Dreamcast never got a US release.
Here's the talked about Lupin the Third, Treasure of the Sorcerer King.
Is that any good of a game, by the way?
No, you know, there are many, many Lupin the Third games from Famicom all the way up to current gen systems, and it's unfortunate. As a licensed title for such a beloved character in anime, there really haven't been any great Lupin games, but...
Cliffhanger?
Yeah, there is Cliffhanger, and that's the Laserdisc arcade game, and, you know, you can't go out and find that now,
no.
So...
And it's hard to say if that's great or just, you know, an interesting period piece, right?
It is. It's something from the history of Laserdisc arcade games and Lupin the Third and Miyazaki, if you're a fan of his animation. But yeah, the PS2 Lupin game's okay.
And he had some Nintendo 64 games that were also sealed, and some of them were good. Like, I didn't even know in my own, I have a pretty good collection of these boxed, and between myself and John and Sean doing the museum, we've been trying to be very careful about collecting full catalogs of game systems, and I saw this, and I honestly was like, I don't think I'd ever seen this boxed before, Legacy of Dark. Turns out I did have it, but I didn't need a sealed copy of it. So this will be showing up somewhere on eBay or in the store shelves very soon. And a lot of these are just, you know, very cool. And, I mean, it kind of goes on. There's more boxes back here. We don't need to go through everything. But he had GameCube, a giant box or two of 3DO, which I think is behind here. 3DO doesn't interest a whole lot of people to look at. But, you know, it's an excellent collection. And we'll see what we can do with it. I'm sure it's going to make a lot of people happy. But definitely the most interesting trade-in that we've had here in the last month. And it's going to be tough to beat. I always say this, but it's going to be tough to beat this. So if we're going to do another podcast for Tales from the Store and it's trade-in related, it's going to be a little tricky to top it.
Joe,
but
I'm sure people are probably wondering when they see something of this volume. There probably aren't many listeners or gamers out there that have this kind of business or have the kind of income that they can dedicate to picking up a collection like this. If it's okay, how much ballpark did you pay for all this?
I think I lowballed them because it was based on a list of games, of which the propensity was PS2 and Xbox, which is something that we just have way too much of as it is. So my cash value was $2,500. I'm pretty sure, looking through some of these things, I'll be able to get that $2,500 back within the next 30 to 60 days. And then there's going to be a lot more stuff that'll sit down here for a while, or will sit on eBay for a while, but I'm quite sure to double or maybe triple that should be very likely.
No shame in that.
We have to pay the rent.
Yeah. This is
and these
business.
Lighting bills. And that's the end of the segment.